Hey there, Rick Sengaria, Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. For the past 8 years, as state treasurer, Beth Pierce has tackled some major financial issues, and one of those issues is the underfunding of the state teachers and the state employees' pension funds for almost two decades, between 1990 and 2010. The state pension shortfall is one of the reasons why Moody's downgraded Vermont's bond rating last October. Treasurer Pierce says it's critical for the legislature to make a long-term commitment to the financial stability of these pension funds.
I think the pensions and working on those in defending defined benefit plans is very important. It is the most cost-effective way to do this, making sure that we don't do quick fixes and stay with our rigor and our financial discipline.
Well, how did lawmakers deal with the pension fund shortfall? Will it help restore the state's bond rating? And why has the treasurer's office gotten involved in a number of high-profile environmental issues? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, State Treasurer Beth Pierce. Beth, it's great to have you here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So let's start, Beth, talking about the bond rating. Last October, Moody's Investors Service announced it was going to downgrade Vermont's bond rating from AAA to AA1, I believe, with a stable outlook. So why did they do that? What were some of the key factors?
Well, I think that as you look at that, number one, we need to work to get that back up to AAA. Right now we have a AA1 with Moody's, a AA+, which is second highest notch in both cases with S&P, and a AAA with Fitch, the third rating agency. My goal is to get to AAA and all, and get us back in that area. You know, when they wrote the report, Moody identified several areas of concern, and really talking about Vermont's aging population and slow economic growth and above average pension and liabilities relative to gross domestic product. In other words, the challenges that we have in terms of our economics and our aging population and the impact they have on other on our long term liabilities. So it's a complex situation. You know, you need to work on your demographics. You need to work also on your pension and OPEB liabilities, and taking a look at ways that we can improve, as I said, some of those trends that we've had with respect to healthcare liabilities as well.
So for folks who are listening, what kind of difference does it make if we have a AAA rating or a AA rating? What kind of impact does that really have?
Well, you know, it depends on how long. You know, when you take a look at the issues, and that's why I really want to get us back to AAA as quickly as possible, and working with the governor, working with the legislature to do that. You know, we had ratings withdrawn by Moody's in 1971 and lost our AAA, and it took us to 2007 to get our rating back. So we lost our rating back then. That's a long period of time. So if it's a short period of time, you know, as you're working through these issues, you can adjust to that. But we don't want to go through a 40-year period with the lower rating. If you were looking at our market, and let's say you were doing we always tack this on $150 million GO as we're looking at general obligation bond. Now, the reality is we're never going to issue that much. But if you take a look at it, the cost was about $1 million over the life of the bond, a 20-year bond. And you say, well, that's not a lot of money. But if you do it every year, that is. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, and again, I also recognize 150. That's the criteria we've used in the past. We're probably going to go out to substantially less than that, probably closer to 100 million or less. The bottom line for us is that the cost of doing a bond reduction is a cost to the taxpayer, and we want to make sure that we do all we can to mitigate that, to see if we can get back to AAA. We actually haven't been AAA. I'd love to see that. But you don't want to be in a position where you just say, well, that's okay, and we're going to go forward, because over a period of time, you issue bonds each year, that can add up.
So when will the next review come? Are you you're probably hopeful, but are you optimistic that there'll be an upgrade?
Well, our next review, we're issuing bonds in July, so we will be sitting down with the rating agencies in late June to take a look at that, all three. You know, I'm not going to predict anything at this point in time. You know, the time period between October and June is not extensive. We've had some good work with the legislature and have done the right things. If you take a look at the budget, we've put more money over the last few years in particular into our pension system. So we're not only paying what's required by the actuary, which is called the ADEC, Actuarially Determined Employer Contribution. We love those terms in finance. But we're not just paying that. We're paying substantially more. Last year, $26.2 million more. We've already put in $10 million this year based on the July revenue estimates. We're making some progress. On the OPEB side, which is Other Post-Employment Benefits, which is a term primarily for health care, and retiree health care. We paid off a loan this year. We worked very closely with the governor's office and the legislature. We had put a loan in place in 2014 to jumpstart that to get us on a payment schedule. We're on the payment schedule. We're increasing our contributions. There's a mix of contributions, including local monies as well as federal, what's called EGWIP. It's not just sandwich in the morning. It's an employer group waiver plan. And we're putting all those together. We put a loan in there to kind of jumpstart things while those resources built up. We were able to pay that down early with a lot of work. Again, I want to thank the administration and the legislature, particularly House Appropriations and Representative Toll for the work that they did on that. Those are good things. We've increased our reserves. We're up to about 13-14% reserves. Those are things that the rating agencies are looking at. Going back to the administration and our health care, we were able to drop our OPEB liability for the states by a quarter of for the state employees by about a quarter of $1 billion, just under $250 million. And that was because the administration worked very closely with the employee groups, took a look at the formularies they use for prescription benefits, took a look at some of the costs related to co-pays and the like, and came up with something that reduced those liabilities. That's the kind of collaborative things that we do in Vermont. Those are good for the rating agencies in terms of not just impacting the liabilities in a positive way, but also showing the way that we do government in this state, that we're collaborative, we work together and find solutions.
So as you look at some of the work of other state treasurers around the country, do you see that that kind of collaboration doesn't always take place?
It's a mixed bag. You know, in the immediate past president of the National Association of State Treasurers, I like that immediate past because the treasurer of Utah gets all the work now, and he's a terrific person. Republican, we work collaboratively. It's a bipartisan organization. But you do see some places where, you know, where something that we got close to last year, and I'm pleased that we didn't, you know, no budget as of July 1st, those types of things. I remember a particular state that didn't pass a budget to something around November for the previous July. That's not good operations. We work very well together. There are other states that I have very high regard for that do the similar types of thing. The capital debt affordability plan. They work very collaboratively on risk mitigation around climate change and things like that. I have a couple of favorite states. By the way, both women treasurers in those two states, Maryland, Nancy Kopp, and the treasurer of Virginia, Manju Ganeriwala, they do incredible work. And that's not to put down the remaining treasurers, if any of you are listening or hear this later. But I think that what we've seen is that leadership makes a difference. And leadership in terms of working collaboratively makes a difference in how you move forward. Blame doesn't help. Good data, working through the problem. And that's the way we've tried to approach clean water. That's the way we've tried to approach our pension liabilities, is working collaboratively with our employee groups, with the administration, with the legislature, and getting the information out there, making decisions based on a fair analysis of the situation and not putting it on the burden of future taxpayers. You know, when you make short-term decisions for instance, back in the, as you said, the 90s or all the way through to 2007, we did not make the requisite amount of contributions to the pension system. That put pressure on future taxpayers. We're paying $25 million more a year. $25 million more a year for the decisions that were made in that period of time. And that's a low estimate. I think it's actually probably higher.
So that's on top of whatever the commitment and obligation is. This is an extra $25 million?
That's correct. Because what we did that got added to the it's part of the unfunded liability because of the fact that, you know, at home, when you take a look at how you're going to fund your child's college education, if you start saving in their sophomore year of high school, their junior year of high school, you're probably not going to meet their education goals, that liability or that cost of providing for that. If you start saving early and disciplined, you know, in preschool, it makes a difference on whether or not you can meet that liability. We need to have that disciplined approach that every single year we're going to put in what's required to make to pay down that mortgage. We developed a plan that's a 30-year plan to pay down the unfunded liability over time, just as you might at home. If you got a mortgage, you take a look and you say, this is my financial resources. This is how I pay down that mortgage or that credit card debt or whatever it might be. We've got a 30-year plan. We're one-third of the way in. We're 10 years into that plan. Let's keep to the discipline, and let's make it happen. And that's the type of thing that works well for Vermont and other states.
So we've been talking about state pensions for state employees and also for state teachers. But you had a program that you were very excited about starting, the Green Mountain Secure Retirement Plan. If I remember correctly, this was a plan that you wanted to put into place for folks who didn't have the opportunity to have retirement or pension accounts at work. And I remember right around the time that you proposed this, there was a staggering statistic that came out of the number of people in Vermont who don't have any retirement money whatsoever. They live completely on what they get in Social Security, and it was like 40 or 50% of the people over 65. Are my numbers somewhere close?
That's very close. We did a study, and what we found is 104,000 people do not have access to employer-sponsored retirement plans. And when you don't have those and you're trying to do those on your own, it's really not it's really not a good equation in terms of having enough money to live in retirement. We baby boomers in particular are not have not been a good example for other generations of saving for retirement. And we are going to have stresses on the budget. We already do stresses on state and local federal budgets because people are not adequately saving for retirement. So we put together a program called the Green Mountain Secure Retirement Plan. This is something, again, we worked that collaborative spirit. We worked back in 2017, Act 69 implemented a plan. It was signed by the governor. I think we had one dissenting vote in the entire General Assembly on the plan, which is something that is extraordinarily doesn't happen very often. And I think there were one or two folks that had expressed some concerns that weren't there that particular day, but overwhelming support, progressive Democrat and Republican support. And I think it's because, again, as you pointed out, there's a severe risk out there. As I mentioned, 104,000 individuals work for an employer that do not offer a plan. 50% of households are at risk of not having sufficient savings in retirement, according to a study done by Boston College. And about 45% of Vermonters, as I said, are in that category of that 104,000. There's a real need. So we put together a plan. It's called the Green Mountain Secure Retirement Plan. Our goal was to implement it on January 1st this past year. We ended up with a little bit of a speed bump, not a crash, but a speed bump with the Federal Department of Labor, where there was a regulatory proposed regulation change. And in the process, They said that all sub-regulatory guidance would be eliminated, and we were relying on that sub-regulatory guidance. They have been very helpful. I do have to give them credit talking about that. We supplied comments to their regulation, but that has not resolved. We decided not to wait, and we asked the General Assembly this year to make a slight change in the wording, so allow us to do a slightly different plan, an aggregation plan, which will get us to essentially the same position. That is part of the language in the budget appropriation bill, and we're expecting that to be approved. We hope that that will be approved, that the governor will in fact sign the appropriation bill, and we'll be able to move forward on a plan, slightly revised plan. But we did not want to wait for that somewhat convoluted regulatory process between Department of Labor and then all the way through the Federal Budget Office and the like. So we move forward with this. We expect we are issuing an RFP, request for proposals, today, based on that slightly changed structure, and we expect to be up and running January 1st of this coming year.
Let's talk to Richard, who's calling from Shelburne. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bob. Beth, this is a little bit off the funding subject. I know you're doing a great job on that, and I appreciate it. This is about the reappointment to the Teachers Retirement Board. As I understand it, that the Retired Teachers Association has the right to designate their member on the board, but for the practicing teachers, they must nominate, and then there must be a statewide election to determine who the teacher representative choice. Why can't they be the same?
Well, I'm going to have to take a look at that, to be very, very candid. I know we just had an election. I think that from our end, that that election process is gives you the opportunity for a wide range of candidates to participate. Why it is different for the other, I don't know whether that's a statute, to be very frank. It's something I'm going to have to take a look at. My apologies, Richard. I'm going to have to do a little bit of research.
Richard, thanks for your phone call.
Richard, let me give our office a call, 828-1451, and we will get that answer for you.
Before we go on talking about financial literacy, I wanted to come back to the pension fund situation for a second. And am I right that the 30-year plan that's in place now has an expectation that the growth rate in the fund will be around 7.5%? Is that right? And if it is that realistic?
Okay. That is correct. Right now it's based on 7.5%. That's a number that was selected not by the board, the board ultimately approved it, but it wasn't developed by them. It was developed by two outside consultants, one our investment consultant, which is NEPC, and the other being Siegel, an actuarial firm. So we had an investment firm, and this investment consultant doesn't invest money. They're not saying, I can get you 12%, I can get you whatever. You know, there's no marketing involved in this. This is a straight evaluation of economic trends, our asset allocation. So we give them, both of them, our asset allocation. They put it into an economic model. They take a look at it, and they make a recommendation. The recommendation for one was 7.6, the other was 7.5. So we went with the 7.5 number. Siegel uses something called Horizon, which is a conglomeration of multiple 30-plus investment firms and institutional investors and what their projection is on a short-term and on a long-term basis. Now, we need to develop that a little more. The 7.5 is a 30-year-plus analysis. It's an economic horizon over the long term. Our short-term horizon is about 6.2 to 6.4 for the next 5 to 7 years. So when we say this, we recognize the short-term environment that we're in, but we also recognize that over the long term, it will rise to the 7.5%. So it is not a one number for each year. Would be my approach, but actuaries and auditors want you to have a single rate over a period of time. So the 7.5 is that single rate of return, but it's made up of economic analysis is over every single year of the pension plan. In fact, way out until the youngest member of that retirement plan retires. We feel that it's a comfortable number. It's in the range of the averages around the country. That said, however, we want to evaluate it every single opportunity, not every year, because you don't make your changes on an annual basis, but we are in the process right now of doing a risk assessment, and part of that is to take a look at the rate of return and the impact that has and the reasonableness of our rate of return. So we're going to continue to look at that and make changes as needed. I think the most important part of this is that we use those outside consultants. We're not doing this. We're not cherry-picking numbers to get the best result that we can. One of the other numbers that's a big impact is mortality. How long are people going to live? And a few years ago, we changed our mortality assumptions pretty significant basis, particularly in the teacher system, recognizing that people are going to live longer. And in fact, when we've looked at those, we might have been a little bit over, I'm not sure the right word is aggressive, or that people are going to live longer than we thought. And in fact, they're living a little, not quite as long as we thought. I'm trying to think of the best way to say that, because I hope that everybody has a happy life and a long life. But as we look at it from an actuarial basis, I think we made some reasonable assumptions there and try to be conservative in our assumptions. We have a requirement in statute to review them every 5 years, but we've reviewed particularly the interest rate assumption, the rate of return assumption, on a much more regular basis since 2010.
Let's touch on financial literacy. That Sure. has been a big priority for your office. First of all, explain to us, what do you mean and what's the problem?
Okay. Well, for me, financial literacy, I actually took this out of an old presidential commission back in the Bush administration. But financial literacy means the ability to use knowledge and the skills to manage financial resources effectively for a lifetime of financial well-being. And I love that last part, a lifetime of financial well-being. I want that for myself. I want that for my children. You want it for your family. You want it for your neighbors. And I also want it for the entire state, that everyone has an opportunity for a lifetime of economic well-being. That's good for the individual. It's also good for the state, because when people have adequate and reliable income in retirement, they buy goods and services. When they buy goods and services, they're part of the economic generator. And that's the goal that we have. Unfortunately, we're not there. I'm going to give you some statistics about the challenges that are pretty scary, actually. Just 22% of Vermonters participated in a financial education opportunity, either in school, college, or through the workplace. Just 22%. 65% of Vermont graduates carry student loans averaging $29,000. 22% of Vermonters say that they spend more income than they generate. They're adding to their credit card debt. And 29% of Vermonters just make the minimum monthly payments on their credit cards, which is a lot of interest. And understanding that, 45% of Vermonters do not have access to employer-sponsored retirement plans, something we just talked about with the Green Mountain Secure Retirement. And 59% of Vermonters have not assessed their retirement needs. So we need to do something about this if we're going to get to that lifetime, you know, of economic and financial well-being.
So do you think, let's take a look at that credit card debt as a good example. Sure. Do you think it's a matter of folks just paying off the minimum amount because that's all they have, or do they really not comprehend how much interest is being charged on those cards and how, you know, if they don't chip away at the principal, they're going to be forever paying this debt off?
I think it's a little bit of both, folks, you know, financial resources are tight and people are looking at it. We have a saying, the pay yourself first. And you should take a look at what you need to do to lower those costs. And understand, I think, that people don't get it. They pay the minimum payments. They're paying a whopping amount of interest. And understanding that and working through taking some classes on credit cards and managing your credit cards is extremely important for adults and something that we encourage.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Tom, who is calling from East Charleston. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Beth. Thank you very much. The commentary on the financial literacy is great, and we certainly need to improve that. But I will have a follow-up question with regard to the teacher's pension.
Sure.
While the assumed rate is 7.5%, my understanding, I'm doing this from memory, that the actual has been running around 4.5%. So my question is, why the difference in the assumption in that 7.5, when in reality it looks like we're just kicking the can down the road with regard to the pension underfunding?
Well, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but if you at different points in time, this is a endpoint sensitive type of data. So when you take a look at the period in the Great Recession, those rates are probably around 5 something, you know, over a 10-year average. They were over 7 or 8 previously, and at one point in the last few months, over 10% for the 10-year for your 10-year return. Now, I'm not going to suggest that we have 5% for a rate of return, or 10% for a rate of return, based on, you know, swings in the market. You know, you have some years where you make 14%, which we have, and some years when you make 2 or 3%. So what we try to do is look at that on a long term basis. And again, if you take a look at the averages, when you move out the Great Recession, it's well over 10 a month or two ago for a 10-year average. I'm not suggesting that. I think that that would be ludicrous on our part and irresponsible to the taxpayer. It is also irresponsible to the taxpayer to lowball the number, because what that does is put more money onto the taxpayer that that they don't need to pay. I think working with our consultants, finding that mid-range of and working through a process of looking at your long-term economic projections, looking at your asset allocation first to determine that, is the best approach. A lot of the reports that I've seen that suggest that 5% or less were written in the period of 2000 up to about 2015, and really have seen the Great Recession is a piece of that. The Federal Reserve and the Fed markets impact on trying to keep the interest rates low, a period of time that I think is not necessarily representative of a 30-year period. Again, we use outside consultants to come up with the numbers based on our asset allocation. We vet those. We put them through a risk tolerance test, and we will continue to do that process. But if you look at just a short period of time, you know, a few years back, as I said, it was 14% that we made. It's not representative. You need to have a long-term look at this, and a look that involves, the use of economic modeling and outside consultants that assist you in that process.
Tom, thanks for your phone call. Let's turn to Ellen, who is calling from Dorset. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the program.
Yes. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Okay. My question is this. I'm a retired state employee.
Thank you for your service.
Excuse me?
I said thank you for your service.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure and something I remember proudly. But I don't feel very proud about receiving my pension in partly from the proceeds of fossil fuels. I am really, you know, I have divested my own holdings in fossil fuels, and I am really concerned having such an investment. And I would like very much for you to at least get the opinions of the other of state employees about this, because I do feel that many of us really strongly oppose that.
Well, thank you first for your comments, and again, thank you for your service. There's something I would like to point out, that 75% of former employees of the state stay in Vermont, pay taxes in Vermont as retirees, and are part of our 78% in state employees and 75% of teachers. So you're really a part of our continued economic prosperity, and hope that you have prosperity in your retirement. You know, we have done the studies, and I'm very proud of the work we did. Back in 2016, I believe it was, we engaged 2015, 2016, and all kind of meshes together, you know, those years, you know what I mean? But the process itself was a very, very good process. You know, we had studies that said, you know, fossil fuels are going to cost you this much. We had studies that said that if you divest, it's going to cost you money. You know, a lot of the studies came from people that might have had a bias in their approach. So what we did is we put together a group of folks, the environmental community. So we had a member from 350, a member from the Sierra Club, a member from VPIRG, and a gentleman from Clean Yield that did a lot of work on ESG and environmental, social, and government investing. And they sat down and they gave us the name of three consultants, three pension consultants, not advocates one way or the other. And we said, we'll do a quick procurement RFP. We'll put it out there and we'll get one of these to do a study. And we're also going to have the environmental community as well as the proponents for fossil fuels, as well as a wide variety of groups involved in setting up the scope. And we actually have audios of those studies and those meetings on our website. We ended up with a company called PCA, Pension Consulting Associates, that did the study. And in the process of doing the study, what they said was that divestment for our plan would not be a wise move, that it would increase costs and add risk to the plan. But at the same time, they helped us identify five ways to move forward, and we have implemented steps in all of those five. We did a sustainability report a few years back. We're planning on doing a sustainability report this summer that will incorporate our progress on these. But we've revised our pension policies and worked very closely with a gentleman from Clean Yield to do that, to include environmental, social, and governance issues in the selection process of our managers. We've also looking at new investment vehicles, passive investment vehicles that would allow us to do more renewable energies. In working with that, we've worked with NEPC to explore ways to increase our renewable energy opportunities and asset classes, and taking a look at infrastructure as well. Looking at ways that we can work with our proxy policy, our ability to go to companies and push issues around environmental issues, social and governance as well. So we made those changes, there are five recommendations. They're on our website. This was done as a result of a study that the environmental community was leading. Once we got the PCA in place, I stepped back. My staff stepped back, and we let the folks on either side of the discussion present data. We said, if you share it with PCA, you share it with the other groups. And we ended up with this process. I think it was very, very collaborative, and it got us moving in five different ways. I also want to point out that in your supplemental plans, your deferred comp, your defined contribution plans, we have a fossil-free option if you want to use that. And to be very frank, employees have not used those options. We've had less than 0.3%, less than 0.3% in the muni, less than 0.5% all across the board of assets that have been invested in those fossil fuel alternatives that we've provided to employees.
We got this email that just came in from Ann, who wanted to know, are we able to find out exactly where our abandoned property comes from, like insurance, dividends, et cetera? That way we can make sure that our addresses are correct and our money doesn't continue to be unclaimed. We've just got a little bit of time left, but this has also been a big push from your office. How does all this money end up in this unclaimed fund?
Well, unclaimed property is about consumer protection, first and foremost. It's money that you might have forgot about. It might be a checking account you forgot about, a utility deposit, life insurance policy that was owed to you. And the companies, the corporations, or what we call the holders, they don't get to keep that money. They're required to send that to us so that we can then go try to find you rather than leave it in their bank account. They need to send it to us. We consolidate those and we get that information out. This is a mind-boggling number, but we have $88.5 million of potential unclaimed property. Over nearly 500,000 claimable properties. I like details, so 485,000. We are paying money out. We had a record number last year of 17,665 people claim their money. We think that's great. You should check on the website, missingmoney.vermont.gov. Or you can call us toll-free at 1-800-642-3191. We'd love to get that money. We've had a record last year of return rate. We want to continue to build. I want a record every year. I want to get all of those dollars back out to everyone. Call us, check the number, and we'd be happy to get those dollars back to you.
And on that note, that's going to be our program for today. Great discussion, Beth Pierce, about the fiscal issues facing the state of Vermont. Many thanks for taking the time to be with us
today. My pleasure. Thank you very much.